Thank you. Hi, everybody. Oh, that's very echoey. Okay, let's do that. How is everybody this afternoon? Doing okay? Good. I like to have a little bit of an interactive sort of presentation style. We will do a longer question and answer period at the end, but if you do have a point of clarification, please feel free to just put up your hand and let me know, okay? And there's a couple times when I'll ask you questions as well. We also have my notes on this screen and you up here, but they're controlled by two different remotes. So if there's times when I look like I'm confused, it's because one worked and one didn't. So we're going to talk about inequality today, particularly as it relates to the labor market. And there's a couple of things that you need to know about me. And one is that I'm actually a millennial. Can you believe it? You're thinking, that's impossible. She's so sophisticated, right? I can't be a millennial. I actually just learned about a year ago that I'm a millennial. I always thought that I was a Gen Xer. And I took a lot of pride in that because millennials have a bit of a reputation. Like, we're often called lazy, we're self-indulgent, we're entitled. You know, some say that we have no work ethic at all. And if you are unlucky enough to employ one of us, then you should expect us to ask for a raise just for showing up on time. I actually read that in a newspaper. I also read this recently. I see no hope for the future of our people if they are dependent on the frivolous youth of today. Ouch. That hurt. That hurt a lot. Or it must have in the 8th century when a Greek poet wrote those words. I kid you not. 8th century. Clearly worry about the next generation is nothing new. Clearly, we've always worried about the next generation. Think about the flower children or what we thought about the great generation even all those years ago. The thing is that much of what we're facing in the labor market today is very different than what my parents faced, what my grandparents faced, and what many of you faced back when you joined the labor market in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. So this up here is a picture of career pathways in the 1950s, in a 1950s firm. You'd see there at the bottom in the blue is entry-level positions and semi-skilled work. Then the triangle gets a little bit smaller. There are fewer jobs available, but still jobs in the green section, which is skilled workers and frontline management. And then, if you're really lucky, you get into the top, which is the orange, which is top management and middle management. I guess some people would consider that really lucky. Not everyone wants to be a top manager. And the thing here is that you used to enter into the bottom, and you could go to school and get some training, but your workplace also provided on-the-job training for you. And if you worked hard and people liked you and you had the skills that fit your company, then you could move up through that ladder. Not everyone could make it to the top, and that's still the case today. Not everyone makes it to the top, but there were pathways to get into the middle, so to join the middle class, those sorts of things. Here's what the labor market looks like today. It's very different. It's called an hourglass, and you can see in the bottom, there's those blue entry-level jobs, and then the middle, the green, it's actually smaller. And those are those middle-class jobs, those middle-skilled jobs, and then knowledge jobs at the top. The thing that's really interesting about this, there's actually many, but one, is that if you kind of get stuck in that entry-level job in the bottom, there aren't those same career pathways anymore. So if you get a job in that bottom section, you're likely to stay there no matter how hard you work, no matter how many degrees you have, no matter how smart you are. The other interesting thing is that if you get one of those knowledge jobs at the top, you're likely to stay there. And I consider myself to be in that top area. And it means that I probably get to keep that job no matter how good I am at it. So I could be really bad at it and still likely to stay there at the top because my resume says that that's what I do. Things are very, very different than they were. But let's go back to the baby boomers just for a moment. The fact is, baby boomers also worked really hard, right? You worked really hard to get wherever it is that you are today. My dad is 58 years old. He owns his own business, and he works all the time. All the time. We were talking on the phone this morning and he had to hang up twice to take calls for work. Our big joke is that when he's retired, he'll only work 40 hours a week. We're hoping. And that's his choice. That's the life that he's carved out for himself. And hard work actually was just a part of the culture that I was born into. I was raised a Mennonite, if you can believe it. I was lucky enough to participate in all that that life had to offer. So we woke up early on the farm, and I can remember Friday night pizza dinners in the back of a pickup truck during harvest season when we were harvesting tomatoes for the Heinz factory. I grew up in Leamington, Ontario. We'd stay late at church meetings or volunteering at different community events, and then we'd spend Sunday afternoons hosting family, hosting friends, and always having out-of-town guests. My parents are wonderful, wonderful hosts, and they made that choice for themselves in their lives. I've made very different choices than my parents. When I graduated from high school, I chose a path that would lead me to a more steady job than farming or business owning does for you. I went to college. I studied hard. I got a really great education. I was lucky to get into Dalhousie University to study economics. But like many of my peers, when I graduated, and this was just, I graduated in 2012, so this was 3 years ago. Like many of my peers, I discovered that there just weren't many jobs available. So let me tell you how the labor market played out for me since I graduated from high school in 2000. Over the 14 years since I graduated from high school, I have had 17 different employers. 17 different employers. I've worked as a waitress. I've worked as a short order cook. I've worked as a hostess. I've worked as a painter. I actually traded painting for rent when I couldn't find a job, so I painted someone else's garage and lived in their basement. I've been a bank teller. I've been a vegetable picker. I've sold flowers in big box stores. I've been a volunteer. When I couldn't find paid work after the painting gig ran out, I worked for 3 years as a volunteer in Southeast Asia to get experience on my resume. It was a wonderful experience. I didn't make any money. I didn't make any money to pay back my student loans. I didn't make any money to save up for a home. But I did end up with some nice things to write on my resume. I've been a management advisor. I've been a research assistant. I've been a teaching assistant. I've been an intern. After all of that, I got a $12 an hour job as an intern. I've been an economist. And now tomorrow, I start my new role at Unifor as a researcher. I'm still an economist. My title is researcher. So those are the jobs that I've done in the past 14 years. And in fact, as I was preparing this part of the presentation about a year ago, I realized that last year was the first time I did my taxes, and I only had one T4 slip. This is the easiest tax return I've ever done. So I had been working for 14 years, and it was the first time that I had one T4 slip. This year will be the same. I'm very excited. And now I'm moving on to a new job, but it's my choice. It's not that a contract ran out. It's not that an NGO ran out of money. It's actually my choice, and I'm moving on. And that actually is a wonderful, wonderful feeling, a little bit of stability, something that I haven't had before. So let's talk about the shift that's happened in Ontario, something that you've all heard about over the last, really, 15 years. This is a chart that shows the change in the number of jobs in different industries in Ontario since the year 2000. The most important thing is the line that goes negative there is manufacturing jobs. So that's 300,000 manufacturing jobs that were lost during those years, and those were all by and large, middle-class jobs, right? People were able to buy homes and cars and choose to bike to work if they wanted, but they had choices. The lighter blue are all service sector jobs. Those are the jobs that manufacturing is being replaced with. And some of those jobs are really great jobs. Let's talk about healthcare and social assistance. What do you think of when you hear those sorts of jobs, healthcare and social assistance? I always think of nurses, doctors, social workers. Those are pretty great jobs. My sister is also included in that category, and she is a personal support worker. So she gets paid $15 an hour, and that's after the mandated wage increases from the government over the past few years. She doesn't know from day to day how many hours she's going to work until the night before. So she gets her schedule at 8 p.m., has to go over her schedule. She doesn't get paid for that part. That's all prepared on her own. Gets up at 5 a.m., and then goes around to all of her different clients. She's told that the $15 an hour that she makes is a premium for the use of her car. I don't know about you, but I get paid per kilometer when I travel. When I drive my own car for work, I get paid per kilometer. She doesn't. So it's a premium that she gets paid to move from client to client. And she doesn't get paid for the time that it takes to drive from client to client either. So that's one way to illustrate income inequality and what's changing, what's very different for millennials now than young people 40, 30 years ago. So the kind of jobs that we're facing are very, very different. So over that 14-year time span, the same one that showed this loss in manufacturing work, the same one where I had 17 different employers, and actually 28 T4 slips. That's a lot of T4 slips. The share of temporary work has increased by 20%. So temporary work has a 20% increase. It doesn't matter if you have a high-paying job or a low-paying job, you might be a temporary worker. You can think of people who work as parole officers right now in Ontario. A lot of them have contracts that go for 4 to 6 months at a time, and you don't even know what city you're going to be working in next. I have a friend who works in Waterloo right now. Her contract is ending in a month. She doesn't know if she'll be working in Hamilton or Brantford or Kitchener-Waterloo. So she hasn't bought a house, even though she'd love to. She has a high-paying job, but doesn't have the stability or the security to make the decisions that she'd like to be able to make right now. Here's another chart. There's a lot of charts in here. I like charts. And it's the share of part-time employees who would rather be working full-time. The blue line is Canada, the rest of Canada, and that purple line is Ontario. So as this shift has taken place, you can see that in Ontario, involuntary part-time work has increased dramatically, while in the rest of Canada, it's actually decreased. And since the recession has held fairly steady. And that's people who have a part-time job and would rather be working full-time, but for business conditions can't get the hours that they'd like. And we have all these stories that we tell ourselves about the labor market, and if you don't have the hours that you want, then you should just be trying harder to find that job that gives you those hours. If they're not available, then there's nothing that you can do about that. And that's a story that I heard a lot growing up as well, and I hope it's one that we can start to tell a different story. Okay, one more chart here. This is the share of workers in select income categories. The blue is 2000 and the purple is 2011. And you can see that this taller section here is people who make under $30,000 a year. In Ontario, in the year 2011, almost 50% of all workers in the province made less than $30,000 a year. Almost 50%. Think about that for a minute. That's the median income, just over $30,000 a year. And that's an increase from where it was in 2000. The people who made over $60,000 a year, that share increased slightly as well. And that middle, it's just another way to show that the middle is declining. People who earned between $30,000 and $60,000 a year, that the number of people has shrunk. And actually, it's not just the share of people. It's actually the number of people in Ontario earning that much money has shrunk as well, which surprised me. So all of that is contributing to income inequality. And that income inequality is contributing to slower economic growth, as well as a whole host of other social ills, including higher mental illness, higher homicide rates, and more teen pregnancies. That's just to name a few, and that's research from around the globe. Income inequality creates some of those things. Higher mental illness, higher homicide rates, more teen pregnancies, to name a few. And the thing is that at both ends of the income spectrum, people face that. So it doesn't matter if you're a high income earner in a highly unequal society, you're more likely to face a mental health issue than if you're a high income earner in a less unequal society or a more equal society. Does that make sense? Everybody get that? Okay. And at both ends of the income spectrum, so whether you're a high income earner or a low income earner, people are facing more precarity as the quality of available work erodes, and people are forced to make hard choices. People like Jalan. This is Jalan and her son. Jalan had a job that she loved. She was a 311 operator for the city of Winnipeg, but she didn't make enough money to cover her childcare expenses, which meant that she literally had to choose between continuing her career or ensuring that her son was cared for. She chose her son. Who wouldn't? Which meant that she had to quit her job and apply for social assistance in order to make ends meet. That was her only job, or her only option in today's working environment, was to quit her job and start accepting social assistance in order to make ends meet. And we, as a society, have made that happen by the choices that we've made. We've continuously lowered the expectations that we have of our employers and our government, and those employers might even be government, small business, not-for-profits, or large corporations. We have responded as a society in fear to the changing economic landscape. We've handed over the power in our labor market relationship to the people who own the capital in the hopes that they will just continue to employ the rest of us. We're basically saying, please just give us a job and we'll let you do whatever you want. You can degrade the environment. You can continue to treat people poorly. You can, you know, skip out on your taxes, and the government might even give you an awful lot of money in order to stay. But we just keep on doing that because we're so afraid that there won't be jobs available. I'm someone who's tired of living in that fear. But we can talk about that later. We're also allowing the quality of work to erode. We've done that a lot. And then we're blaming the individual. So we might blame Jalan. Let's go back. We might blame Jalan for being on social assistance, even though she made the best choice that she could at the time. Because here's the thing. The nature of work has changed, but the stories that we tell ourselves about work have not changed. We tell ourselves that higher education always leads to a good job. We tell ourselves that work is the best way, the best pathway out of poverty, no matter what. And this one was my dad's favorite when I was growing up. If you don't make enough money to make ends meet, either change what you want or get another job. Always sounded logical to me. Always sounded logical to me. But how are you supposed to change what you want when you can't even afford your rent and to buy food or to pay for the heat in your home, even though you're working two jobs? This is what's going on today. Many university graduates are working low-skilled service sector jobs because there are no other jobs available. So people are underemployed. Almost 1 million workers in Canada, 1 million workers in Canada are holding down two jobs just to make ends meet. 32% of all workers are working these two jobs in order to make ends meet, and 32% are working in involuntary part-time work. So they'd rather be working full-time, working more hours, but they can't find the hours that they want. That was a point where my two slides got mixed up. Okay, so what does all of this mean for our work and for our life? And the work and the life of the next generation, of my generation. When you hear people talk about the future, you hear a lot of talk about innovation, about entrepreneurship, all of these other things. We talk about the skills gap. We talk about all sorts of things. You know, one thing that we don't talk a lot about is taxes. I love talking about taxes. Makes some people really, really uncomfortable, but I love talking about taxes. What do you think of when you hear the word tax? Anybody? Can just yell it out. It doesn't have to be positive. Pardon me? Share the wealth. Social services. The price we pay for a civilized society. I can tell that we're on the same page in this group. The last time I was in a presentation and asked that question, someone said, oppression, and I went, uh-oh. I was a little bit nervous, but it worked. So some things that I think about when I hear the word tax are education. Think about the roads that we drive on. Think about the pipes that bring water to your home. The list goes on and on and on. Another thing that I think about when I hear the word tax are cuts. Cuts, cuts, cuts. That's what we talk about in the public discourse all the time when we're talking about taxes, is that they're too high. They're too high, right? Is that something that everyone's heard a lot lately? Taxes are too high. I'm going to tell you just a few things about taxes. We could talk about this for a long time, but I know it's a heavy topic. So this is from a government paper, a federal government paper that was written 2 years ago. A small business earning $500,000 a year in profit pays more than 50% less tax than it did in the year 2000. Is that higher? It's an awful lot lower now than it was in the year 2000. So we have this story that taxes have just been increasing and government is burdening us all the time with these taxes, when in fact, a small business earning $500,000 a year pays more than 50% less in tax than it did then. Here's another one. Canada's corporate tax rates. The first is in 2006. So this is a chart from another economist here in Ontario, and he was comparing tax rates under the Harper regime. So that's why it starts in 2006 and goes until 2014. Again, here's a story of we hear that taxes are too high, but actually they used to be 22%, and now Canada's corporate tax rate is 15%. So that's 7 percentage points lower than it was only 10 years ago. That's a pretty huge drop. One more interesting little tidbit is that the amount of money that corporations are now holding just in cash has actually surpassed the amount of federal debt. So we've heard a lot about these deficits and, oh, everything is terrible as far as fiscal policy goes within the government. It's actually not true. And also, since 2006, as corporations have seen this lower tax rate, they've been saving more money in their bank accounts, and there's actually more money in corporations' bank accounts than there is in federal debt. They could just wipe the federal debt clean. Yes, the blue line is the corporations, the red there is the federal debt. Here's another thing. Oh, sorry. Yeah, and that is something, that's a story, I think, that we tell ourselves. Corporations aren't leaving. Oh, the question? So the question was, what about the flight of capital? Are we worried that if we were to keep tax rates high, would corporations leave? Is that maybe what you're asking? So that's a great question. What we do find is that business owners take into account a lot more than just tax rates when they're looking at where to start a business, where to locate a business. Depending on the kind of business you run, you might also look at quality of life for workers. For example, Silicon Valley, based in California, beautiful, beautiful area. I don't know what the tax rate is, but not very many hours away is Nevada, where the corporate tax rate is zero, and nobody's rushing to Nevada in order to start their business or plant their business there. They're staying in California. It's just kind of one example of that. And we have seen these stories that we tell ourselves are just not playing out the way that economic theory might expect. And we can talk about that more maybe in the question and answer period. So another thing that I think about when I hear the word tax, Brussels sprouts. They taste terrible, Brussels sprouts taste terrible. Although the other day I had them deep fried and they were delicious. But Brussels sprouts taste terrible, but they're very, very good for you. Just like taxes. It's not fun to pay your taxes on every paycheck. It's not fun to see that money that you could be spending on something else. But it is. Taxes are very, very good for us, and they pay for all sorts of things that we need. Here's a picture of Toronto. I know you can't see what's written in those white boxes, but every single white box is a public service. It's something that's paid for by our taxes. Amazing, right? You can look at, there's a streetcar, there's traffic lights, there are the beautiful flowers in front of the library, there is a fire hall, all sorts of things. You could also, again, think about the pipes that carry water to all the different places. There's the traffic lights, the street crosswalks. The list goes on. I'm going to give you one example as a millennial about what has changed for me as the labor market has changed, as we have cut taxes. It means that we have less money to spend on services. And this is one way. Oh, this is where our slides aren't even the same. So this is one way that things have changed for me directly in my life because we have cut taxes the way we have. In 1989, students paid for 14% of the cost of a university education. 14%. And in 1989, a middle-income family, probably a family like mine, could earn the equivalent of 4 years of tuition in 87 days. So you had to work 87 days, almost, or 3 months, in order to pay for, or earn enough money to pay for 4 years of university education. That's the 14%. So fast forward to 2012, and this is research from the CCPA, the National Office. 2012, this is the year that I graduated. Students paid 44% of the cost of university education. It's a 30 percentage point increase. 44% of the cost of university education. And my family, my middle-income family, could earn the equivalent of 4 years' tuition in 195 days, more than double. So these are ways that things are changing. Everything you earn. Okay, so let's talk about this for a minute. In 2012, my tuition was $10,000. That was 44% of the full cost. So the full cost was $22,727, the full cost of my tuition for a year, 44%. Now, if we had gone back to when we were paying 14% of the full cost, then my tuition would have been $3,181 of that $22,000. So that's a huge difference. That's almost $7,000 that I would have saved every year in order to pay for something else or to not have so much debt. That would have been really nice to have a little bit less debt when I graduated. Does anybody have any questions about that or can you relate? Can you relate to that a little bit? These are all ways that income inequality is affecting my generation in a very different way than it affects other generations who didn't have to borrow so much money to go to university, who were able to access those better jobs and those career pathways that I talked about earlier. My generation is having a very different experience. They've raised what the student has to pay for, and we have had a lot more people going to university as well. So if you look at the amount of money government puts into university education as a total, you won't see a decrease. But that money has to be split between a lot more people than it did 20, 30 years ago. Pardon me? Yes, Yes, there has. It's just that it has to be spread out over more people. So the illustration is that I am facing a very different reality than was faced those 20 years ago. And it plays out in all sorts of things, including, well, again, the jobs that you have, housing prices, mortgage rates, the list goes on and on. So this is just one example. We could also talk about childcare fees for young families. Those have skyrocketed. Housing prices have increased far more quickly than wages. The price of even public transit goes up a lot faster than wages do. The list goes on and on. No, I've not ever seen that kind of research. It'd be really interesting, though. I haven't. Okay. 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 So again, what does this all mean for our work, for our life, for the work and life of my generation? When you hear people talk about the future of work, about the future of our province, you hear a lot about innovation and entrepreneurship, as if they're these magic bullets that are going to get us all through the mess that we're in. If only people would work harder and the government would just get out of the way, then they could let us be creative and they could let the free market do its thing. We hear talk about a skills gap. We hear talk about people needing to, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps in order to get ahead. So then the government really feeds right into this narrative. We get all excited and we throw all sorts of money at the innovative sector, at the tech sector, for example, hoping that as many people as possible might become the next Steve Jobs. Do we have, you know, 100 Steve Jobs sitting in this room? Is that what we have? Did you know, this is what we're really asking, or what's really happening when we ask people to take all of the responsibility for themselves? Did you know that the average self-employed app developer, and most of them are self-employed, makes an average of $500 a month? $500 a month. So that's a pretty big risk to ask people to take. We'll give you a bit of money now to encourage entrepreneurship and innovation. You might develop the next Angry Birds, or you might end up with $500 in your pocket to take home. And that's what this competition is doing. We have competition in the app sector. Every once in a while, someone makes it big, and they might sell their app for a couple $1 million, and every once in a while, you hear about a $1 billion sale. But everybody else is working in their garage for nothing. And not everyone is going to make it to the top if we still had that triangle, right? Not everyone is going to make it to the top. Now, we do need to keep in mind, though, that innovation and entrepreneurship are really important. And I'm not trying to say that we don't need innovation and entrepreneurship, but they are not alone any sort of silver bullet. We must also ensure that we're addressing the larger questions around the nature of work as we ease into the transitions that are taking place in our economy. And that's not happening. Have you heard this one before? There's a story about NASA in the 1960s. They were getting ready to send their astronauts into space, but they had to create a pen that would write upside down, a zero gravity pen. And no pen at the time would do that. So they spent $12 million and 10 years creating a pen that would do the trick. The Russians had the same problem, and they sent their cosmonauts up with pencils. Two different approaches to solving a problem. We can have the innovation, entrepreneurship example, or look for the tools that we already have at our disposal. So whether or not this story is true, some people tell me that it's true, some people tell me that it's not, it really illustrates the point nicely. We can throw money at a problem, or we can take a step back and think about the solutions that are actually going to get the job done. And I have a couple ideas, maybe not quite so innovative and flashy as sort of innovation and high-tech things. Something like benchmarking the minimum wage so that it is actually at a level where people can make ends meet. What about searching out living wage employers or finding and encouraging employers to pay a living wage, because not only is it the right thing to do, it also is good for the bottom line. We can talk about the changing workplace review, community benefit agreements, anchor institutions, other community supports. We'll go through a few of these. The minimum wage, that's just a graphic of the different minimum wages across the country. No matter what province you live in, if you work full-time at a minimum wage job, you live in poverty, flat out. If you work full-time at a minimum wage job, you don't earn enough money to live above the poverty line. And that's something that I think needs to change, particularly if we're going to continue telling ourselves that work is the best pathway out of poverty, then we better make sure that people who are working hard in full-time work can actually pay their bills. And at the CCPA, Ontario, we would say that the minimum wage should be benchmarked to about 60% of the average industrial wage, which would mean that as people at the top are getting wage increases, people at the bottom would be getting them as well, and everyone would move along that continuum together. The second one is to talk about the living wage. These are different living wages in Ontario. Hamilton is recalculating right now, so it'll be a bit higher. But right now it's $14.95. Waterloo Region is $16 an hour. And in Toronto, the living wage is $18.52, which is a lot lower than I expected. So a living wage is what it takes to make ends meet. It means, it means that you can pay your rent, and it's representative of a family of four with two people working 37 and a half hours per week. One child is in daycare, one child is in school, and they're paying for their rent, their food, all of the basic necessities, but they also have enough money to participate in the community. So there's money there to go out for a coffee every once in a while, to buy birthday gifts and other things that we as a society kind of expect of each other and do for each other when we're participating in community. And that line there at the bottom, the gray, that's the minimum wage. It's far, far below what it actually takes to make ends meet. So if you're an employer in this room or you know an employer, you can sign up in Toronto to become a living wage employer and then start paying people what it takes to make ends meet. Okay, Ontario is also going through the changing workplaces review right now. The government has recognized that not only do we not have proper enforcement of our labor standards, but our labor standards are not built for what's going on in today's labor market. So we are going through this review right now. People are recommending all sorts of things in order to improve or raise the floor for people so there's less opportunity to be taken advantage of. Now, most employers do not take advantage of their employees. I want to make it clear that I do not think every employer is bad. But there are people that do. And when we have low standards, then it lowers the standards for the rest of us, and it lowers our expectations of what an employer, government, etc., could be doing for us. Another solution is community benefit agreements. This is another law that has been passed in Ontario. Any infrastructure project from now into the future in Ontario must have a community benefit agreement built in, which means that the local community will benefit. You hire local people to do the work. You hire people who are maybe don't have the same potential as others. So right now, the Eglinton Crosstown is a great example of a community benefit agreement where people who live along the Eglinton Crosstown line are being hired as apprentices. They're being trained in order to make sure that the money that is spent by the government stays in the community and that people are getting training in order to, if there is a career path for them, find it and move up that career path. And then a final one is to look at not only the side of employers, but to also look at what the government can do. And here we could talk about all sorts of different government supports that people need. And one would be to build a universal child care plan so that young families who are already paying these higher debts and much higher mortgages, if they're lucky enough to have a job that can afford them a mortgage, then we could also see a decrease in the amount of money that people have to pay for childcare, which would allow sort of a more equal playing field for people and allow women to stay in the labor market while their kids were little, if they chose. And it would actually give people real choice. You want to go to work? Then there's an affordable alternative for your kids. And if you don't want to, you want to stay home, that's still a viable option. Okay, here's the thing. People are living far more insecure and unstable lives than we did 30 years ago. The nature of work has changed, but the stories that we tell ourselves haven't. The only solution that we hear about is this, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship. We just need technology that will solve all of our problems. And we're sort of talking about the solution all the time, but we haven't stopped to figure out the bigger question that will determine everything. What is the future of work, or what will the nature of work be in the future? Do we want to continue to live to work, or do we want to work to live? For decades, we had moved to the latter, but as job quality has eroded, public services have been squeezed, we're increasingly slipping into the former. Again, the nature of work has changed. The stories that we tell ourselves, higher education leads to a good job, work is the best pathway out of poverty. We tell ourselves these stories, but are they still true? No, I don't think they are. The fact is, not everyone gets to be an entrepreneur. Not everyone will innovate, but everyone deserves a decent quality of life, whether they're a cleaner, a baseball player, or a short order cook. I'd like to add baseball player to my list of jobs, but I haven't gotten there yet. And in addition, all of the innovators and all of the entrepreneurs out there actually need employees. You can't run a business without employees, from app developers to caterers to custodians. So the bigger question is, how do we create stable, life-sustaining work and community supports for everyone? Isn't that the conversation that we should be having? I think that's the conversation that we should be having. It's not an easy conversation. It's not an easy conversation at all. And it's not new. And in many ways, it's the continuation of a conversation that was started during the Industrial Revolution. My great-great-grandparents and my great-grandparents, they also faced disruption. They transitioned into factories from fields and farms. They also fought to stop child slavery. They gave us the weekend, thank goodness, and working conditions where we expected safety on the job. Those are things that they brought in 100 years ago. And now it's our turn, and we're at a time when we can actually do that again to make the workplace better for everyone, not just the few who make it to the top of that hourglass, but for everybody. Do you remember what it felt like when you first started making your way into the world? For many of you, it was probably before kids, it was before mortgages, sort of those first years as you were trying to figure out what were your dreams and how you were going to get there. You probably thought that it would be possible to get a good job, have a predictable income, to own a home, to retire one day, and that if you got sick, you would be able to afford your prescriptions and have the health care that you needed. Or if that you wanted to get an education, it would mean that you were not indebted well into adulthood. My generation is delaying having relationships and children because we don't feel secure. And owning a home is pretty much a pipe dream, particularly in a city like Toronto. But for the first time in my life last year, and last year I was 33 years old, I finally had one T4 at tax time. And that same employer is the only T4 slip I have when I do my taxes this year. First time that's ever happened. So, the way I see it, we have two choices. We can promote an economy and a society that is survival of the fittest. Or we can choose to spend the money that we have, and make no mistake, Ontario and Canada are extremely affluent jurisdictions. We have the money to ensure that everyone has a fair shot in life, and that if we lose, if we take a shot, innovation, entrepreneurship, that we still have enough money to make ends meet if we try and we fail. Is this survival of the fittest economy really the best solution that we can think of to develop the just and the fair society that we all strive for? Or are there other solutions at hand to help people live the life of their dreams? I hope that's what we can talk about this afternoon. Thank you.